I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Tim McLaughlin. He's a poet, a spoken word artist, and a teacher. And he is doing an event this coming Sunday, the 4th of January at 5 o'clock at the Institute of American Indian Arts, Hogan. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. You're always such a wonderful hostess.
Oh, it's great to have you. And the evening that you're doing is called Poetry of Nature and Spirit for the New Year. It's kind of a New Year's event.
Yeah.
Now, and we're going to talk about it in a minute because there's a lot going on in that event and the whole spirit of that event, but many people who are listening right now probably know you, or at least know your work, through the work that you did at the Santa Fe Indian School.
Yes.
You started the spoken word poetry program there.
I did. Yes.
Tell us about that, and I mean, that had a real life, and it was an amazing opportunity for the kids who got to participate in it.
It was, yeah. It was a magical time for me to be there at the school, and in total, I worked in Native education for about 13 years, first in South Dakota, and then in Montana, and then here for 10 years. So my work continually evolved and got to that place of, I guess just sort of working with the students and helping them discover the poems and stories that wanted to come through and how they wanted to express them in the voice and in the body, and then complement them with Native songs and Native dances. And we created a theater show and a CD and documentary film and toured the world and did all sorts of things. It was an amazing creative wave to ride.
And some of those young people ended up in some of the top colleges and art and music schools in the nation. And it was one of those kind of golden moments. And then I find it so interesting because, I mean, you are an artist. Those things, even when they're the most fabulous thing ever, come to an end.
Yeah, it did come to an end. And, you know, and I think that's part of the mystery of things as they are, that they have their moments sometimes, and whatever length things need to live for is exactly what they're meant to be. And I think that work is living on in those students and what they're doing now with their lives. And in my journey, you know, part of it was my own journey as a poet and a writer and an artist. And now I heard the call very distinctly through prayer that I was meant to move away from institutional education and go more into the creative realm, into a more free terrain to write the work that's wanting to come through me.
Now, were you able to use, or are you able to use, some of the techniques or teachings that you taught the kids in your own work?
Absolutely. I mean, like anything that we do in life, we're always learning as we're giving. And so my own writing voice was gestating and developing through the process of helping the students find and discover their voices, and also the way of embodying poetry, which is now my central artistic and spiritual devotion, which is not only to listen for the poems and then shape them and bring them into the flesh and into the body and then onto the page, but then to take this final step, and that's part of what I'm doing this coming Sunday, which is to embody the pieces, bring them back into my body, and then activate them by sharing them out with people. But I often do that in the mountains too, and hear the responses that are there in the natural world, which is where many of my poems come from. I feel like I'm hearing what the earth is wanting to speak through me. So they're not really my poems per se. They're just little bits of truth that I'm trying as best I can to articulate and shape into a music.
I love the idea of listening for poetry rather than quote-unquote writing poetry.
Right, or thinking it up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've heard that many times. I've heard it from poets and from novelists and from all kinds of people. And I think there's an analog in sculpture where they've got a stone and they kind of let the piece emerge from the stone as if it were already there in some way.
That's right. Yeah. And I think we're in a place now in our world where it's you have to really decide to listen to the natural world and to the more subtle currents of what might be spoken and what might be shaped into our languages. You know, there are many other languages in the water, in the wind, in the rising moon, and all of what's happening that's very magical, and yet we're many stages removed from that. in the way in which we live nowadays. And so you have to sort of tunnel down and get to that place of real stillness to say, everything that I might have been thinking is secondary to whatever needs to be spoken. And that's what's so beautiful about poetry, is that it's non-linear and it's not prosaic and it doesn't have that sort of one-to-one agenda. It opens up a set of possibilities instead of trying to pin down a certain thought or a certain storyline or anything like that. It invites people into a world because you've got a combination of not only the content but the sound. So the sound and sense work together in a beautiful way, just like songwriting. And people now are going to singing as a spiritual practice and a way of becoming healthy and connected and enjoying life more. And I'm here to say that we can do this through the spoken voice too, and that there needs to be more fluidity between our singing voice and our speaking voice, and that as we speak and become more fluent in the language of poetry, our voice literally changes. It becomes sometimes gentler, softer, more beautiful, more textured and nuanced, and also more honest. And so you feel yourself speaking more from a deeper, more true place, and then the response from other people and from the world around you becomes more honest, and that just sort of snowballs into a beautiful way of being with language. It transfigures our relationship with language and starts to quiet things. We have so much noise, we have so many words, and we need to still some of that chatter and reintroduce breath and silence into our speaking and our listening.
I have often thought about the fact that, I mean, we evolved in nature in a place where there just weren't as many words per day as we have now. And trying to imagine, I mean, hunter-gatherers spoke, but they didn't speak all day. And they did other things. And I sort of try to imagine sometimes, if I'm outdoors, let's say, what the context is in which our sort of evolutionary verbal nature is expressed and how it interacts with the world and how it's quiet.
Sure. And, you know, I think part of that is in what sense now do we think of the self as our set of thoughts and our inner conversations and outer conversations, as opposed to the self as being sort of a body first, a beautiful marriage of spirit and matter. And so when we use the voice, there's a reverence when you're using less words, and there's a reverence when you hear voice of another person or of a bird or the wind. And if you're a hunter-gatherer, you're attuned to all of these voices very keenly. And in fact, you can't speak for much of the time, or otherwise you won't have any food.
Right.
If you're just out there chattering,
right.
You're not hearing what you need to hear.
We're talking to Tim McLaughlin, who is a poet and spoken word artist. I was wondering if you might read a poem.
Absolutely. I'll recite it.
Oh,
instead
great.
Of reading it.
Ladies and gentlemen, here in the Santa Fe Baking Company, Without Paper.
Yes. To walk free along a high ridgeline, to plunge into the smooth skin of sea, to lie still on a fresh pallet of felled needles, to stretch my heart over the long strobes of dawnlight. This is what this body was formed for. This is the pure prayer of pleasure that the earth sings into my simple and simpling ears. Why would I choose anything other? The mountain is never closed shut. The waters are not too busy burdened. The trees will not refuse me. And the sun reaches into my window each morning. I stand and expand. Feel his warmth cup my face. Let my flesh enjoy its essential truth. Give the body water, and it gives back thanks. Give it air, and it breathes back grace. Give it that sunfire, that fresh forging, and it will slough off the worn cells and bake the new self. A pot, a bowl, a cup. To hold a drop of blessing, given or found, and gifted back to Earth's wide, warm lap.
Tim McLaughlin reciting his poetry, and I was thinking as you were reading that, I mean, you might go out into the mountains, say, or by a stream or whatever, and listen for the poetry, but then the process of crafting has to be a huge piece of it for you. Tell us about that process, sort of the life cycle of a poem from the time you first start to hear it, as you say, mm-hmm. until it's done. Mm-hmm.
Well, as you know, as a writer, there's many different ways to approach that process, but I would say, yeah, there is sort of an arc to it. There's the feeling or the intuition that something could be wanting to bubble up and come into the form of language. And as a poet, you know that feeling, and the more you do it, the more you become familiar with it and know how to access it. So that listening is an active listening, but not a forcing. You know, there's a subtle difference there. And so as the music, as I hear it, starts to take form of words, I let it flow out onto the page, and let a lot of silence punctuate that listening, so that, you know, I don't really believe in this way of just sort of gushing out and then trying to mine through for the poem. In terms of poetry, there's this way of really hearing and knowing which word, and each word sort of starts to come, and then you're getting into a place that's like a trance or like a fixation, where the voice of the poem takes over your body and mind, and then the music comes and feeds the next line and the next line and the next line. And there's so many surprises in that I think is the joy and the ecstasy of writing poetry. The surprises and the turns of phrases and the little bits of music that are holding this, you know, potent content together. That's what just breaks me apart and holds me down and does everything that you know, that's what a poet lives for, really, that moment of creation. And for me, from that place, I let it sit, and then I would go to a more formal place of, well, how is this going to live on the page? And as a reciter of poetry, the relationship between the page and then the embodiment is a whole dance that is still very mysterious to me and really beautiful. But the sense of saying, how do the lines shape, and how does this fall, and then where is the real product, you know, the final sculpture, so to speak. And then the step that I think is extremely important, that I mentioned before, is to embody the work and activate it. And for me, that's also part of the editing process. I cannot really know if the poem is completely finished, as much as it's going to be, until I have memorized it, learned it, and spoken it out. And then I can hear, oh, that word, no. And this whole section can change or shorten or condense. And only when I'm in that place of not reading from a page, but feeling it and feeling everything as I'm speaking it, can the poem have its final form.
What is the role of reading poetry, reading other people's poetry, sort of being in the world of poetry?
As a poet, or?
For you as a poet.
Yeah, reading books of poetry, you mean. I think for me, it's part of the conversation between those of us who have this vocation to work with language in this particular way, so that it's sort of my responsibility and my pleasure. I'd say, well, maybe the other way around, my pleasure and my responsibility to read and listen to those other voices and converse with them. And then sometimes to choose a poem that another person has crafted and find its universal truth as it sings in me. And so that's another way of writing or creating, is to say, okay, this poem, if I embody it and speak it out, what shape and music does it take on? So that's a big part of my process. And I think what happened to me in the earliest stages of my writing life would be that when you're immersed in a certain author's work, you're over-influenced in a way, or some of their music starts to creep in. And it's only when I really became still and sort of removed myself from the fabric of society that I really felt the purity of the voice that's wanting to speak through me. And that all those other poems and all the ones I've written before, they're all there, but this new one is coming in its own way, in its own life, just like a new child.
Well, speaking of a new child, you have little children in your life.
I do.
Recently, your wife had a child, and I was wondering what the role of children was in your poetry, and your, and not only in as subject, but sort of as sense of life cycle.
Yes. I mean, fatherhood is central to my life. You know, fatherhood and husbandhood and poethood are all the three pillars of my life. And I mean, one thing is that in some sense, hearing my son's presence from the womb and even before the womb, instructing me and showing me the way in which he wanted me to live.
What do you mean before the womb?
Before he was conceived, we had a sense of this presence coming to us, you know, and so that was part of what was changing me and saying, it's time for you to step out of being sort of a father figure to so many other children and be ready to really root in with your two children. And just feeling that this presence and the wisdom and intelligence that a human presence has when it's in that place of getting ready to incarnate. And it's, you know, it's not a distinct language, but messages and feelings. And I was tuning into that and saying, okay, I'm changing my life. And one of the very tangible manifestations of that was that I went into our backyard and started to build an adobe sanctuary, almost in the style of a hogan. And I felt that our little boy, Tig, was guiding me in that and saying, this is where I want to be born.
Oh, and my goodness. Is that what happened?
And that's what happened. He was born in this incredible round adobe sanctuary that I built, and the door was facing to the east. And I didn't know exactly where one of the examples of what I mean by the baby working through me was I didn't know exactly where east was when I raised the door frame, because you'd need to be on the equinox to have pure east. And this was in July. But I set the door and felt into where should this be? And on the equinox, which was a couple weeks before he was going to be born, the sun rose just shy of the middle of the doorway. And all of a sudden, I understood what happened, that this sun would rise in the middle of this doorway on the day that he was born. And that's precisely what happened, almost like a Chaco Canyon type experience. And it was magical for me and beautiful. And that helped empower me to say, that's the way in which poems come, and that we can do this, and that specifically you are supposed to do this, Tim.
Very interesting. We're talking to Tim McLaughlin, and that's, I mean, it's the same word to conceive a child and to conceive of a poem.
Yeah.
And is it the same experience, is it a similar experience for you?
It is, and it isn't, you know. I don't think there's anything that can compare to procreation. Especially when it's done consciously and beautifully and in conversation with all the elements and all the forces of nature. But yes, I mean, poetry for me is in some ways just as powerful and just as beautiful an experience. And, you know, and to go back to what you said before, when you have children around you, and particularly when they're very young and they're just having the first buds of language happen inside of them, and even pre-verbal, the sounds that are made, that is just a rich, rich landscape for a poet to explore. And then to say, well, what types of language do I put in the environment of these children? And for me, it's always poetry and things that have a lot of euphony and have a lot of magic to them and a lot of sense of rhythm and harmony and all the things that I want him to feel in the landscape of language. And so just even last night, our little baby recited Humpty Dumpty and Little Miss Tuffet for the first time. I didn't know those pieces were inside of him, but they were. He stood up on a block in the middle of our living room and spoke poetry and then sang.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
So he's not a little tiny baby anymore.
He's two now, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you are going to be doing an event this coming Sunday called Poetry of Nature and Spirit for the New Year. It's an evening of recitations of poetry with you, and you will be also working with your wife, Mari Sato, who's
yes.
a wonderful vocalist.
Amazing. Carrier of songs from so many lineages and songs of the moment that she's hearing, just like I'm hearing poetry. She's so tapped into saying we're needing to find new songs for now. And some of them are meta language, you know, not even necessarily in a particular language, but the syllables and sounds of this moment. So she and I work together quite often through concerts and also through retreats and workshops, helping bring people into this sort of spiritual practice of singing and reciting poetry and being in the voice in a sacred way. And I'm also going to have a few musicians with whom I'll collaborate, and a dancer. So it's going to be a mixture of many things and a beautiful evening.
Is it a choreographed evening, or is there a bit of improvisation in that?
Absolutely. There's a bit of that listening and letting the moment move through. The concert is very deliberately set on the first full moon of the new year, and 5 p.m. is just about when that moon rises. And there at IEI, at the Hogan, the doors are to the east, and we'll be, you know, charged by all of that and by the fireplace that's there. So for me, I've done a lot of work creating these pieces and embodying them, and I know that has its own energy. And then the collaborations are more fluid, where we are in dialogue with each other, but there's a lot of speaking and dialoguing in the moment too, in terms of the instruments and the voice.
Now, in this crazy world in which we live, which is urban, and many of us are, like it or not, really out of touch with the cycles of nature, and that listening for the true word, listening for poetry, listening even to ourselves, is hard to do. What do you have to, like, do you have certain boundaries and limitations that you put on your own life so as not to get distracted by all the kind of crazy junk that our society offers?
Absolutely. I feel that I have to be very committed to poetry and what it's wanting to do and say in and through me. And so one of my devotions, you know, and I held this devotion even as a young single man, as a teacher, was to go into the wilderness weekly. You know, and that sounds sort of regimented and not necessarily intuitive and et cetera, but I think in today's world we have to sort of schedule these places and times where there's that freedom and expansion. So that devotion to be in the wilderness on a weekly basis is a big part of it. Because there, the work, as I call it, can be done so beautifully and so efficiently even. There is just a pure connection in terms of writing or in terms of listening for a piece or reciting or just knowing what my next step is. That's a place. And having this backyard sanctuary, which is a ready-made womb in which everything is safe and comfortable, and yet the energy is very strong and moving. You know, we don't bring our stuff into that place.
Right.
It's the fireplace and the blue corn hanging and the mud floors and mud walls. And that's changed my life to have a space like that where I can, in the midst of raising children and all of that, just sort of walk in there with a beautiful reciprocal agreement with my wife about when and how we both get a chance to be in that space. It's a big part of it. And just limiting when am I in the realm of poetry and when am I in the other realm, the mundane realm of practicalities.
Right, right. Tim McLaughlin is a poet, he's a spoken word artist and a teacher, and once again, the event Poetry of Nature and Spirit for the New Year is taking place this coming Sunday, the 4th of January at 5 in the afternoon at the Institute of American Indian Arts, Hogan, and that is down at the Institute campus.
Yeah.
And once people get there, they can just kind of like find it.
We're going to put some signs out, but it's on the far eastern side. The Hogan is sort of isolated in its own location beautifully.
And he will be reading poems, and there will be music and dance, and you're also working on a book, and when that comes out, we will have you back on the air.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Tim McLaughlin, thank you so much for being with us in the Radio Cafe.
My pleasure.